Bootstrapped Web, episode 87. It's the podcast for you, the founder who learns by doing as you bootstrap your business online. And today's kind of a special episode. It's actually a conversation between myself and Craig Hewitt of Podcast Motor, and he's also the co-host with Dave Rodenbach of the Rogue Startups podcast. And so this conversation today is being broadcast here on Bootstrapped Web, but it's also being released as an episode on their podcast too, over on Rogue Startups. So I don't know what you call that in the podcasting world, kind of like a double podcasting, simulcast. I don't know. So Jordan's not on this one. It's just a conversation between me and Craig. But Jordan and I will be back with our episode as normal. Hopefully, hopefully next week we'll get our schedules in order and we'll get back to our normal recording routine there. But you know, Craig and I had a really good conversation talking all about our respective productized services, and I think it was really interesting because you know, I'm running Audience Ops and Craig is running Podcast Motor, and our businesses are actually very, very similar, just doing different things. So they're very similar in that we both kind of run a production line type of ongoing service. We're doing blogging in Audience Ops and they're doing podcast editing. And so we kind of, you know, spent a good hour really kind of diving in and kind of comparing notes about what we've learned so far in our businesses and how we get things done, how we work with a team. We got into hiring, we got into processes, we've got into marketing and scaling up and profitability. We kind of touched on all these different aspects of launching and growing a productized service. So hopefully, you know, we don't get lost too much in the weeds there for you, but it kind of gives you a good insight into what the day-to-day looks like in this type of business. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Craig Hewitt. Enjoy.
All right, welcome to the show. Today I am sitting down with Brian Castle from the Bootstrapped Web podcast and founder of Audience Ops. I think most of you are familiar with Brian, so let's just jump right into the conversation. Brian, how's it going, man?
Yeah, good, Craig. How's it going, dude?
It's going good.
Yeah, you know, and I guess we had talked about kind of, what do you call it in the podcasting world, like simulcasting this? Or
yeah, I think it's a double cast.
Yeah, so this will go out on the Bootstrapped Web podcast as well. And you know, on there I've been talking, I mean, you know, Jordan and I kind of our weekly updates about what we're working on, and obviously I've been talking about Audience Ops a bit. But I think it's actually been a couple of weeks now, or several episodes since the last time I really did a deep dive into productized services, which of course I write a lot about and I teach a course about it, and I run now it's my second productized service business, so it'll be good to kind of talk a little bit more about like behind the scenes kind of nitty gritty of what actually goes into building it and running it on a week to week basis. And yeah, so
but yeah,
you know, you and I had been talking about this because Podcast Motor is actually in many ways very similar to my business in Audience Ops, not just the fact that they're both productized services, but they're actually very similar types of productized services, in that we both manage a production line of content. You know, I think from week to week, we're publishing a whole bunch of blog articles for our clients, and you're publishing a whole lot of podcast episodes for your clients, and that happens on a rolling like week to week basis.
Mm-hmm,
so it's very similar in that way.
Yeah, and you know, I think that if I had it my way and could sort of design the perfect productized service, it might look a little bit different than what we do. I mean, I'm very happy with Podcast Motor and how it's done, but one of the things that I think is a little bit challenging about what we do, and you might feel the same way about, you know, writing blog articles or having your team write blog articles for customers every week, is that it is a very sort of creative and artistic thing, and it leaves some room for subjective interpretation. And so what we find sometimes is some customers, maybe very few, I guess, you know, sort of come back and say, oh, what about a this and a that? And then, you know, your version of like, what about a comma there? You know, sometimes I feel like if I was able to pull out my magic wand and say, hey, this is going to be the perfect productized service, it would be something that you either deliver once where you deliver in a very objective way, where there's not as much artistic room for interpretation, because I think it's one thing that interrupts the productization of a service is so much of this artistic input and room for interpretation on the client's part, where you can say, all right, this is the thing we deliver, and they come back and say, well, yeah, but I want it like this. I think sometimes as we're scaling, we're finding that something that is a little bit challenging, and we're sort of working to optimize our service and our product, I guess, to sort of optimize that.
Well, I'm interested to dig into more about what you're seeing with podcast episodes, because as some listeners may know, you know, we Bootstrapped Web, Jordan and I, are clients of Podcast Motor, and you guys do our editing for this podcast. And I'm assuming that we're very different than most of your other clients. Like we're probably very, very hands off with it compared to other clients. Like we literally just hit record, drop it in Dropbox, and let you guys do your thing. And we like that. We like kind of like the unedited approach, even though you guys do some editing and cleanup. Like we like most of our content to stay in. So I'm interested to hear like what are the issues that other clients come up with. So maybe we can dig into that in a minute. With audience ops, with blogging. Well, the other kind of difference about what we do is that we are the ones creating all the content for our clients. Mm-hmm. It's not like they get, and we're also coming up with the topics too. Like we do a lot of initial research for each client, and we build. We actually do a pretty intensive process internally for us to come up with topics that will really resonate with the business's target customer. And then we recommend that as like, this is the calendar of topics that we're going to do for the next, you know, couple of months. But basically we have a pretty standard process for creating posts. Of course, every article that we write is different. It's a different topic. It's for a different client. So it's unique in that sense, but it follows a standard set of guidelines that we have. You know, every article comes in at around 1,200 to 1,500 words. Every article comes with at least one custom designed graphic by our graphic designer. We've got some like formatting stuff where like, you know, use subheaders in this way and try to use some block quotes in this way and things like that. So that's kind of, you know, formatting wise, everything is pretty standard, and we haven't had a whole lot of feedback on that. What we do have a feedback loop with our clients though, where we send every client an email a week before their next post goes live. And so our project manager, Kat, will send these emails out, and she sends like a whole bunch of them every Monday. And so that way the client can see a link to the finish. It's basically a finished blog post. They can see the draft in WordPress, and it's scheduled to publish a week later. So they have about 7 days to take a look and give us any feedback that they have. And sometimes clients come back to us, you know, they'll hit reply on that email and just have a couple of points like, oh, you know, we'd like if you mentioned this, or, you know, there's this aspect of our product that we'd like to kind of highlight as an example here, you know, something like that. And with a couple of days notice, our writers can certainly, you know, get that incorporated into the blog post, no problem. And the other trend that I've seen happen is as we onboard new clients, that feedback, that those kind of revision requests that we get, it can be somewhat intensive for the first couple of weeks of working with a client. And sometimes we're kind of under the gun, you know, instead of one or two tweaks, they're asking for five or six, and they don't actually come in until like 2 days before the post is supposed to publish. And yeah, it can be kind of a crunch for us. But I found that it does die down after the first month or two. And it's kind of like a getting to know you process where, okay, we understand like these are the things that are important to you. Our writers are also learning more and more about the product and about the audience as we go along as well. So, you know, we're kind of building up all this knowledge so that by the time we get into month two, month three, we kind of fall into a pretty good groove with the client. And I mean, for many of our clients, they receive those Monday preview emails from Kat, and a lot of them don't even reply, you know,
Yeah, which, and that's me most of the time. I mean, yeah, full disclosure, I guess Podcast Motor is a customer of Audience Ops, and you guys do a fantastic job. And the blog has really taken off since you guys took over writing for it. But yeah, I mean, Kat sends me the email on Monday, and I very rarely have anything of note to add to it or to the email that you guys draft up. So you draft up an email for me in Drip, and yeah, I mean, it's spot on, you know, most all the time, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, so we also write and send the email newsletter, and we give you a preview of what, you know, what we wrote in there as well, and it's all lined up in MailChimp or whatever you're using, and but you do have the opportunity to take a look, and yeah, you know, it's funny, like Kat was saying to me the other day, she was like, you know, a lot of our clients like don't even reply to these emails, and so she was wondering, like, is that okay? Like, is everything okay with them? You know, and what I said to her was like, you know, I think that's a big part of our value proposition, and it's almost like a good thing when our clients don't reply to those emails, because it shows that like we're taking this off of their plate. It's like these are very busy founders and people running companies that, you know, I know that they like receiving the email and knowing that it's getting done and things are getting produced, but they don't necessarily have to reply or give us any feedback. And I think that they see that as a good thing. At least that's the feedback that I've had from our clients. So
yeah, they don't necessarily want to see under the hood, right?
But you know, I mean, we do. And actually, early on, this was something that was an issue for us that we had to work through, because in the very first few weeks of Audience Ops, we didn't have a full week buffer in between the preview and the publish date. Like we were sending that preview maybe 2 or 3 days before the publish date, and then we'd have like all this feedback and revisions from clients, and then it was like, oh, we have to push back the publish date, and now we're under a crunch, and that happened like several weeks in a row. So then we had to work through this, like we had to shift our whole production schedule back a week, which took a few weeks for us to phase in, you know, because basically for an article that gets published on like, there's basically like a 4 week process time, from like idea to the writer starts the draft, and the writer takes about a week to write the draft. And then we take a full week for us internally to do copy editing, graphic design, setting it up in WordPress, queuing up email newsletters and social media posts. Like we take a whole week doing just that stuff. So that's like two weeks now. And then the following week we send the preview to the client. And then it's a whole week after that to wait for any feedback from the client before it actually gets published.
Oh, you lucky bastard. I think, no, and it's a shortcoming on our side, I think, but the truth is have not been disciplined enough to set these expectations straight with our customers. And in turn, we get some shows, the raw audio files the day that they want them published. And so what that really does for us, it puts a crunch on me as kind of the organizer of the whole system. It puts a strain on what is now our full-time producer and on the team doing the technical work. So we have to scramble around to have this sort of fit everyone else's schedule, when in turn I know that, and like you've set this 4 week expectation with your team for you guys to produce these things. But we rely so much on the customers giving us a big chunk of what the end content ends up looking like, that we're a bit at their, I don't want to say at their mercy, but on their timetable as to when things can get produced. And I think it's probably up to us ultimately now to say, okay, we're going to get this out, whatever, a week after you give us the audio. And that gives us time to do QA. It gives us time for our audio guys to really do a bang up job. It allows our writing team to write really good show notes with tweets and quotes and embedded images and things like that. So I think the onus probably should come back on us to do a better job of say, hey, for you to get what you really want to get out of our services, we need just a little bit more time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if I were you, I would try to just standardize that as much as possible, you know, just have like a standard policy. And, you know, maybe like the default is
you know, a 1 week turnaround time from the time that you guys receive the audio to the time that it's like published ready. And if they need something faster than that, then charge more for that. You know,
yeah, I like that.
I mean, it costs you more resources to get it done faster, right? You know, to kind of push something up at a queue to get an editor to do it. And when you guys are doing the show notes too and creating a graphic, I mean, that's more work that has to be done. And it's not just, I'm sure you do things similar to that. Like, we don't just, like the writer doesn't just create we don't just draft a blog article. They do a draft, but then it goes through our internal editor. And then it also goes through a graphic designer. And then another project manager does like a final checklist on everything to make sure everything was done right. All of that before it even gets sent to the client. So, you know, in a client's view, they're not necessarily seeing all that goes into it. They're just like, to them, it's like, oh, just create a quick graphic for this show note. I mean, how long does that take? But it actually takes a while to have all these like checks in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have a few checks in place throughout our process, and what it really ends up looking like is each person checks sort of the previous person or the previous step in the process, and we're really sort of just building that out now. But it's been really helpful, and we've caught some what are just, you know, human errors, but since it's all a human process for us right now. And it's been nice to sort of catch that before it gets to the customer. And at any one of sort of like four steps throughout the process, we've been able to catch a few things along the way. And it's a real testament to the team working together by itself and apart from me, which is a really nice thing to see the team kind of take full ownership of the whole process. I think it's, I don't know, it's just really been nice.
Yeah, and you know, for those clients who need a fast turnaround, like they record today and they need it published by tomorrow or within 2 days or whatever, can you just publish the audio episode to iTunes and then say, you know, the show notes will come like a week later?
Yeah, we can. You know, the show notes are used in the ID3 tagging. I mean, it's a little technical, but the show notes are used as part of the production process, and it really helps kind of the SEO juice of your show within iTunes or Stitcher to have all the content from the show notes. But you definitely can. And whenever we can, we like to. We have a show that we sort of have to push that out there pretty quickly for. And then some of our customers want to tag the files themselves, and they just don't put show notes on there. They'll just put a real short description linking back to the actual blog post page that has all the details for it. Because, I mean, the reality is not a lot of people go through on their phone and click links and things like that. I think it's more for the website itself. And the reality is some people just really want to have the show done as soon as it can get done and essentially live. And for those people, I think we just need to say, hey, we'll get it done as soon as we can and up to a week or whenever your next scheduled post is supposed to be.
And I think like for us, we totally realize that a lot of the issue with our show is that it's on us, that we don't, you know, we try to record and publish every week, but it's just we get busy and we do traveling and things, and it's we have to skip a week here and there. But I think that Jordan and I both would agree that we don't expect any faster turnaround because of that.
Sure.
Like, you know, I think a week turnaround for us is totally reasonable.
Okay, I'm laying the law down then. All right, so let's talk about team building and hiring and the process that you've been going through. We have, I think, similar sized teams at Podcast Motor as you do with Audience Ops. And we've done the vast majority of our hiring through Upwork. We just are hiring our first person outside of Upwork. And it's been a positive experience on the whole. There's always sort of trial and error and vetting and things like that we have to go through. But I've found really high quality people. Our team is very distributed. We have two people in Europe and the rest are in the US. And I think maybe we'll talk about VAs, and, you know, foreign VAs in a little bit. But it's been a process and been something I've been really involved in. But, you know, it's just sort of tough. It's not been a slam dunk, I guess. And there's been a lot of work that I've put into it. So I don't know, what are your thoughts on like where you guys have been finding people and what does that process look like and kind of some things maybe you've learned along the way? Because I sure have learned a lot.
Yeah, I think it depends on the role. I've used different sources to find candidates depending on the role. So the first role that I was hiring for on day one of Audience Ops was writers. And I think I hired about three all at once in the first month. And now we have five writers on the team. All of them are US-based. I found them all through a combination of inbound.org and the problogger.net job board, and those are, you know, like writer specific job boards basically.
And so right now all of our people up until almost, you know, right now actually about 2 weeks ago, yes, everybody has been sort of hourly and or on a contract basis, and now we're just moving into hiring our first full-time person, which has been a really big move and sort of a mindset shift a bit to get myself there and to get the business there. But it really needed it. I mean, it needed a lot of that hand-holding and, like you said, running the internal process on our end. But most of your folks are still hourly, is that right?
I think at some point in the next couple of months, at least two of them will become full-time employees. I haven't made that transition yet, but I think we'll get there in a couple of months. By the way, of those five writers, two of them now double as project managers. So like Kat, who you know, who you get emails from, she's also a writer, and she's actually writing for one of our other clients now. And so I actually like that. I like that the project managers have a background in writing, and they can also do some writing as well. Like our other project manager is kind of like our internal project manager, and he's a writer as well, but he actually does most of our copy editing. So I think that works out pretty well. And then the other roles, we now have three assistants in the Philippines. I just hired the third one this week. And I have gone back and forth on this historically, and even in my other businesses, I've usually used Upwork to find virtual assistants in the Philippines. And this time around, I tested out, what's it called? Virtual Staff Finder.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a one-time service, one-time fee, and they quickly match you up with three highly vetted virtual assistants. I was fairly happy with that process, I think. Our first two assistants in Audience Ops came through that. And that worked out pretty well, and they're with us now. They've come into the team nicely. For this third one, I actually went back to Upwork.
Right, right.
And the reason for that is that this third virtual assistant is actually not doing the same things that the first two are doing. The first two are kind of working in our production line, where they're in charge of putting the articles up in WordPress, queuing up email newsletters and social posts, and you know, formatting blog posts and all that kind of stuff. This third one is now helping me out with some marketing and sales related tasks, and I'm kind of working through some new processes there. And so I found him on Upwork, which I've done in the past, and that worked out pretty well. I kind of hired two, and I gave them the same task, and both of them basically did the task pretty well. But the one of them was clearly a better communicator than the other one, and that's the most important thing to me. Like if you're asking me smart questions and you're setting the right expectations, you know, saying things like this is what I'm doing today, and this is what I'll get done tomorrow, and you know. You're sending me mm-hmm. an email once or twice a day with an update, and you know, being clear about that and making sure that you're answering all of my questions. That's the kind of stuff that's, you know, I think that stuff is even more important than talent or skill.
No doubt,
because the skill and the process can be trained over time, and the communication is just going to make the training much easier.
Yeah, I mean, one of the sayings I heard recently was, I think the Apply Filters guys said that, you know, they hire attitude over aptitude, and I think that's spot on. I mean, every time that I've had a bad experience with a hire, it's been because, you know, they just don't care, or they're not trying, or they, you know, you can just tell when somebody doesn't give a shit. But I think if somebody can communicate with me and express what's going on, really engage in what's going on, and the process and the quality, then that's almost all that I care about. And that goes for age and background and geographic location. I mean, we have people almost all over the world, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Our graphic designer is based in Argentina, and he's awesome. Found him through Upwork as well. Does a really good job. I mean, I've hired designers in the past over the years. Like, I come from a background in web design, so I've worked with different designers and developers. And I've hired them through a number of different ways and from different places, a lot in the US and stuff. But this guy works out really well in Upwork. And I actually like working through the Upwork system for some of these roles, because it just kind of automatically handles the hourly pay and logging of the hours. And you know, for part-time contractors, I think it's a good system. For our other team, our teammates, like the writers who are US-based, it's actually kind of a pain, because we use Hubstaff for them to track their times. Like, they have basically timers on their computers, and that kind of logs their hours, and then they just manually invoice me with PayPal, you know, twice a month. Which, you know, it's fine. You know, I just have to kind of like manually pay everybody twice a month. And I mean, Hubstaff is supposed to integrate with PayPal to make it automatic. And I've tried to set that up, but it just doesn't work. And so, yeah, kind of a pain.
Yeah. No, I hear you. That's we're getting ready to bring our first person in. I think, like I mentioned, outside of Upwork, we actually hired her from hiremymom.com. It's fantastic. I recommend it for anybody who wants kind of like that 4 to 6 hour a day person that can really handle your stuff. It's fantastic. But since she's coming from outside of Upwork, we're needing to find another solution for logging hours and invoicing and paying and stuff like that. And so we're using Hubstaff too, and really excited about it. I think it's a really neat tool. Those guys are part of the whole transparency movement, so that's cool to be involved as a customer with a company that's part of that too. So just a little side benefit, I guess. But yeah, in general, the team is pretty mixed. I mean, we have a handful of folks that are still operating within Upwork. All of our editor guys, we pay on a per episode basis, just because it's a pretty well-known amount of work that they're having to do. It's one episode, and whether the episode is 30 minutes or 60 minutes, kind of all comes out in the wash to be something fair that we've all agreed on, and everybody gets paid the same amount. So that's really nice that it's sort of fair and equitable there. But we, you know, two of the writers are still through Upwork, but now I think we'll start moving more and more people from Upwork, whether they're an hourly or a sort of project basis, over to Hubstaff, just so it's kind of one place for me to go and one place to manage everything. And like you said, it should offer direct integration with something like PayPal, or maybe even through my bank account directly, and should keep track of things like 1099-ing and withholdings and things like that. I would imagine that that it's sort of a full service, complete solution. So yeah, really sort of excited to get digging into what it's about. And I guess the last part is we did start off with a full-time VA from the Philippines. We used Virtual Staff Finder as well, and sort of initially thought it was going to be a really great solution. And it did start off very well. And I think in the end, it probably came down to my shortcomings as a manager as much as anything. You know, the time zone difference really got me. I'm in Central Time Zone, and so it's 13 hours ahead for me. So really had very little overlap in working hours. And so even though, you know, I do work a fair bit in the mornings and in evenings, it's just a lot to ask me, I think, to sort of be ready to go and be engaged a lot during what I think should be my sleeping time. So it didn't really work out for us to keep working with her. And I think if I did it again, it would be under very different circumstances, and probably involve asking someone to overlap at least a few hours a day, just so that we can keep the continuity going within the business process, or have someone who can work asynchronously and has really well-defined processes that they go through, and not something they need to learn on an ongoing basis, or you know, these tasks that revolve or change every time, something that's very well defined.
Yeah, I actually have those guys. They're working through their night shift and they're working on US day hours.
Oh, interesting.
And I paid a little bit of a premium for that. I mean, It's still obviously very affordable compared to hiring people in the US. That was one of my initial requirements when I had set it up with Virtual Staff Finder. Was, you know, you have to be available 40 hours a week, and you know, U.S. business hours, you know, are like these hours Monday through Friday, and for this particular role, that's just really important for us because, you know, they're working on this production schedule and they're working directly with our project managers, and a lot of times we need to have them do like a quick edit or a quick fix or something. And we just kind of communicate that back and forth in Slack, and we can't have like a day of buffer time just to get quick requests done.
Sure. Yeah.
So I think that works out pretty well. But I think that's just a matter of setting expectations from day one. And like, that's definitely like an interview question. Even though I said that to Virtual Staff Finder, once I got on an interview with each of them, like that's definitely one of the questions that I get a clear answer on. Like, are you available to work these hours? And I mean, believe it or not, this may come as a surprise to most people listening, but virtual assistants in the Philippines, not all of them, but many of them are actually accustomed to working that night shift, because so many people in the Philippines do work remotely for clients in America and, you know, North America and Europe, and so a lot of those clients, you know, require daytime availability. So, you know, quite a few virtual assistants have kind of, you know, adjusted their schedules accordingly. Especially, you know, the younger guys, like in their 20s, they're kind of just out of college, they're able to kind of do that sort of thing. In my last business in Restaurant Engine, it was sometimes an issue. I had the same deal where I asked our support team to work the night shift so that they're available during the day. And over time, you know, some of those teammates were with me for like 3 years. And over that time, like one of them had a child and got married. And then once that happened, you know, the night shift was kind of not as doable for him. And I mean, luckily by that point, we had some flexibility on their team where he could shift into the day shift, and then other people kind of took over the night shift and we kind of worked it out. But you know, I think it's just an expectation to work out. And like, for example, when I went through Virtual Staff Finder, you know, their thing is they give you three candidates. My main reason for going with them initially is because I have gone through Upwork in the past. And when you go through Upwork, you get like 20, 30 candidates. And then you kind of have to sift through all of them and vet them and hold a bunch of interviews. And I saw Virtual Staff Finder as kind of like a way of forcing me to just make a decision quickly and not spend too much time on this. And I think it did its job, because it did give me three quality candidates. I did find that one of those three, when I asked her about the hours and her availability, she said that she could do part of the night shift, but she was also doing some work for another client. Like, she wasn't available for 40 hours. So I was like, yeah, that's kind of a deal breaker. So, but I ended up, you know, bringing the other two on. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at some point as we scale, for profitability reasons, as much as anything, we're going to need to, utilize, some labor, they can get some of these very basic things done. And I think the Philippines is a great thing for that. I mean, it's a fantastic place. Everybody speaks English. It's a very family oriented environment. And I think a lot of it actually translates really well to folks located in the US. The biggest downer for me, and you touched on it before, but is the time zone thing. And if I can find a better way to manage that, I think it's a great way to be able to scale your business without decreasing your profit as you go along.
Yeah, and I think it also depends on the role too. I think what you're doing is pretty similar to what I'm doing in that those type of VAs need to be available in real time for us. But I'm the last person on my team who's kind of like a regular team member at this point, I would consider is our developer who's working on our WordPress plugin that we're developing. He is based in the Ukraine. And he doesn't work like in real time. Like he's basically working through the night. And I think for that type of role, it doesn't matter as much. Like I'm fine with giving him, I'll post issues in GitHub or whatever. And he'll get back to me, you know, 2 to 3 days later. And that's not a problem because we're kind of just like developing something over a long period of time. And I don't really need him to be on call or anything. So.
Yeah, no, that's great. I think that's one of the benefits of a distributed team is folks can work kind of on their schedule and don't have to be beholden to the 9 to 5 that so many people are trying to get away from, right? So, but hey, so one of the other things I wanted to touch on maybe is we were both at MicroConf Europe, and I know we were in similar conversations, people asking both of us, hey, does this thing scale, right? You know, the typical place where people think they can scale as products, whether it's a physical product or a software product, but can a productized service scale? And I'm sure you've gotten this question 1,000 times. And I see our business to where we at the people that we have in our business right now, we have capacity for probably 50% growth. And the nice thing, I think, from what I see in our business is that we are poised to be able to add people intelligently. We've figured that out, I think, at this point, what it needs and what it costs to be able to add people. We really have the system down, which I think is probably the most important thing to sort of master the input of. So once we've figured out what it really takes to run the machine, we just have to add more people to it to start putting out more episodes and have more customers and all this kind of stuff. And I think along the way we'll be hopefully as profitable as we are, which would be really nice. But I think to the people who ask, you know, can this really scale? The answer is absolutely, but you got to get the nuts and bolts of it, you know, right ahead of time, so that you don't run into these scaling issues that I think so many people have in their head. You know, specific for our business though, the one thing that we've run into a bit of a bottleneck with is the writing, and it's where your bread and butter is made. And I'm sure it's been a challenge for you to hire well, but you know, there's only so much that someone can do writing show notes, or they have to listen to an hour long podcast and then write a really good sort of one page summary around that. So that's kind of been the bottleneck in our business so far, is finding really good writers that want to write about this stuff and can do it for a relatively affordable price.
Yeah, exactly. You do run into, I mean, we haven't exactly run into this yet, but we will. You do run into that issue where it's just not enough hours in the day. Like you can't just fill like 5 roles on the team and expect 5 people to serve 50 to 100 clients. Like it's going to have to multiply at some point.
Yeah. What do they say? 9 women can't have a baby in a month.
There you go. You know, so I think with a productized service, the nice thing about it is that you can launch very, very quickly. Like literally within a week, you put up an offer, you start getting clients, getting revenue in the door. Of course, that makes it sound a lot easier than it is, but it's certainly possible. Businesses have done it again and again, getting paying clients within the first month. And the other nice thing is that you can start to actually deliver the product, deliver the value within that first month. You don't have to go spend 6 months building out some software. You can literally start giving them what they've paid for immediately. Now, in the very early days, it's a messy process. Like you have not documented your processes yet, you built your systems, hired the right people yet. So it's a lot of hustling and figuring things out as you go. And that's exactly what it's been for me. I mean, this is my second productized service business, so I am able to do things faster than I did in the first one. But the nice thing is that you can launch very quickly and get a few clients on board very fast, but then the scaling up process is probably a slower, more methodical path to go down. So what we did was I signed like a batch of first clients in the first month or two. And then I think by month three, that's when our system got pretty overwhelmed because we're so new, right? Like we had about a team of five at that point. And even like those writers and everybody on our team had hours in the day. Like they still have extra hours that they could contribute to audience ops. But at that point, we didn't have systems and procedures to make sure that things didn't fall through the cracks and to make sure that we always delivered the level of quality that we need to. Edits are being done and graphics are being done and publish dates are being met. We had to have systems in place for all of that. So by month three, I actually shut down all sales and marketing and didn't sign any new clients. I actually turned away or put a bunch of clients on waiting list for a good 2 months there, for like months four and five, or like months three and four, I think. And just really heads down, focused on our processes, the tools that we're using, documenting, getting the right people in place, training them on how we're going to do things and redoing a lot of stuff. Like I'd write a bunch of processes in the first month and then by month three realize, okay, I have to redo this and change the order of how we do things. And like I said earlier, we had to shift our schedule so that we give an extra week of buffer time. Like that took some time to work out. So I got all those kinks kind of worked out in months three and four. Now we're talking, I think it's been about 6 months. And so now I'm back to like pushing on sales and marketing. And we've been, we've been adding a few more clients over the last month or two. We're now ramping up some marketing stuff. So I expect to really just kind of ramp up the client list over the next couple of months. And I think now we're ready for that. Like now we have the team in place. We've got the systems totally dialed in. We've got project managers that have already taken a lot of the stuff off of my plate. So that really all I'm focused on now is doing sales, marketing, and a little bit of the onboarding and strategy work up front. But the writers are really doing most of the creative work there, and I'm just kind of giving some input. And so now I think we are ready to start really ramping it up. I think there's still a limit, or at least there are like certain milestones where things need to be reorganized. Like I think the next thing that'll happen for us is... So I think our current team has, they all still have available hours that I can still ramp up with them. But eventually we're going to start bringing in a couple of more writers and also the way that we manage the process. You know, like I could see it breaking out into like different units where like one project manager plus like two writers and an assistant handles these eight clients, and then we kind of duplicate all that, into like groups of like eight clients or so. I think that's kind of like the traditional agency model, really, is to like break up into small units.
That's how we have it structured. I mean, we have the same audio guys work on the same show every week, and we're starting to organize the writing team into the same sort of buckets, just to where people have consistency, not just on like the style and what they're hoping to expect out of a show, but on the content and the context. One of the tough things for you, it's the same for us probably, is we're writing about a huge variety of topics. And even though you have the podcast to go off of, you don't know, like a lay person might not know what buffer is or what a podcast even is. But coming in and try to write this, it can be kind of tough if you are starting from scratch every month. And so, that's one of the things we try to do is try to streamline it so that the team's expectation is a little more straightforward.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we do assign the same writer to the client, like one writer is the one, is the same one writing all the articles for a particular client. And unless in some in some cases, writers will double up on their plan with Audience Ops, and they'll have us do like 8 articles a month instead of 4. In that case, we put 2 writers on that client, and each writer does 4. So, and I think that's actually good because it kind of mixes up topics and voice and things, which is nice.
Yeah, the voice is really tough to master, we found.
But the, let's see. The other thing that I was going to say about this, all right, well, 2 things. One of the challenges that I'm starting to face now, and I don't know if this really applies in your business, but I also try to match writers with certain clients and the audiences that they'd be best writing for, given their personal background and expertise and areas of focus. I mean, all the clients on Audience Ops, I try to make sure that they're all generally selling to businesses, that they're all generally like online businesses, either selling software or like a productized service or something. And there's that overall fit, but then each individual client, like for example, you're a client and actually, I don't know if you know this, but like early on with Podcast Motor, we switched the writer for you guys So to a guy named Trevor, because Trevor happens to be like a podcast junkie, you know, and the first writer isn't as much into podcasts as Trevor is. So, so we put him on and I think he's been really good. And so, you know, just things like that, like trying to match up the right skill or the right background expertise with the right client. So I'm starting to think about which writers we need on the team and which writers. And also like which clients we can go after based on which writers we have on the team and things like that. So that's one thing. And then the other thing about scaling up is we're also looking ahead into kind of phase 2 of the Audience Ops business. Like it's not just going to be the done for you service. We're also going to get into selling software, selling tools, and even eventually getting into like selling educational products. So we have some internal tools that we're using for our clients. Like we have a plugin for doing content upgrades, which are like email opt-ins on blog posts. We're getting ready to release that as its own standalone product. We've got about 3 or so additional plugins that I plan to have built over the next year, which first and foremost, they'll help us serve our clients better. They're like content marketing related little plugin tools. But they're also valuable standalone useful tools that others can use. And so I'd like to get to a point where we have one section of our business is the done for you service, and that drives a chunk of the revenue. And then we've got, you know, selling tools, which are much, much lower priced, you know, selling licenses to these plugins. And that kind of scales up because we're selling those to like hundreds, potentially thousands of customers. And then eventually selling either an ebook or a course or some kind of training that helps to teach what we do from a content marketing standpoint and kind of tackle it from all these different angles and also kind of vary, you know, diversify the revenue sources. The key there is to make sure that all these things still serve the same audience. And for us, that's, you know, founders of online businesses and they're who need to use content marketing and put it into action.
So how do you balance the blending of priorities between the service that you're fulfilling for customers and looking at both information type products and software type products? The only reason I ask is we're looking at both. I think both would fit podcasters very well. There's a lot of information out there about podcasting, but I think a lot of it can be done better, particularly for business-focused podcasts. And I think there's a ton of technology gaps in the podcasting space these days that we're looking at solving. And I sort of have a hard time keeping focused in general. And so trying to figure out how I can diversify our interests while still sort of staying true to what the business is really all about and you know, getting into all these other types of businesses, I think, is good because, like you said, it diversifies your exposure and your risks and serves the customers better. But I want to make sure I do it in a way that doesn't dilute the core of the business, and, you know, the done-for-you service, like you said. And I guess the other part of it is the allure of a product, whether it's a tech product or software or a information product, is the margins. I mean, you build the thing once, it could cost a fair amount of time and money to build, but then every time you sell it, the profit is close to 100%. And there's a lot of allure in that. I mean, we have a pretty significant cost of human capital to get our shows out the door. And the thought of increasing our sort of profitability per unit sold is pretty appealing. I don't know.
Yeah. And we see the same thing. I mean, the current, just the done for you productized service is profitable. And it's working out very well, and it's definitely going to grow. And that really solves a burning pain for a lot of companies. And I'm sure the same is true for you with podcast editing. So I think that'll always be there, but yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it. When you're selling software or information products, I mean, the profit margin there is huge. It also allows you to serve different segments of the same market. You know, like we're going to be selling plugins and information to people who probably won't hire us for the done for you service. There might be some overlap and they might turn out to be kind of lead generators for the done for you, maybe, but really it's for people who either A, can't afford the done for you, or B, have no interest in outsourcing it and actually want to do it themselves. And so we're giving you the tools to do that. So I think it is important to think about, like, even within one single market or one audience, there are different segments who have different types of needs. And I think growing out the product line is a good thing to do there. I mean, the hard part about it is to take your time with it, right? Like to say to yourself, like, Okay, this year it's really just about the done for you service, and next year we're going to get into that other stuff. Yeah, you have to kind of hold yourself back. At least that's been my thing. But you know, looking at your business, Podcast Motor, this is what I was speaking about in MicroConf Europe. You know, whenever you do get into software or selling or educational products with podcasting, you would have never been able to do that had you not launched the done for you service first.
Sure.
You know, if you had never established Podcast Motor to begin with as the go-to company if you want to run your podcast and do it the right way. And of course, you know, building up the revenue and the team and the infrastructure and the brand, all of that has been done through your done for you service. Then it allows you to launch the next thing to that same audience. I mean, if you were to just launch some podcasting software without having built any name or brand recognition, not to mention sinking your own money into developing a big software product, it would have been a much harder, you know, uphill battle. But you can actually, like, roll it out and kind of, you know, have the done for you fund and give and accelerate the next phase.
Yeah, no doubt. And for me it was just you know, allowing myself to get the business sort of standardized and now looking at other options, and we're going through validation of that right now. But yeah, it's tough to ignore the shiny object when it's there. But I think, you know, staying with your core business, like you said, to get you in the place to launch other things is really key.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely struggle with it. I think this year I struggle less with the shiny object syndrome, meaning, like, I'm not really chasing other projects that aren't related to audience ops. I'm just totally focused on audience ops, and this is going to be my long-term focus for a while. But there are lots of little things that I want to do within the umbrella of audience ops. You know, I've already registered domain names for the next 3 or 4 plugin products that I want to launch, and we only started building one of them.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to not get ahead of myself and try to get all the pieces in place first with the done for you and build that up, and then and just try to prioritize my focus and just the focus of the whole company, you know.
Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's exciting. I think this whole idea of productized services, at least from what I've seen, obviously, because I write a lot about it, is it's definitely starting to resonate more and more this year, especially with people who are kind of freelancers, consultants, or just looking at starting their first software business. I'm seeing it as like a bridge to getting there faster and to kind of, you know, take it kind of one step at a time. But it's interesting, and it's definitely a lot of hard work, and it's kind of a different process, a different path to putting all these pieces in place than it would be using the traditional MVP of some software idea and then hiring a developer and getting a couple of first paying customers for a SaaS. I mean, it's different than that. It's, you know, it's working out systems and procedures and doing a lot of things manually and sticking with manual processes over the long term. So,
yeah. I mean, in my mastermind group, I'm the only one doing a productized service, and, you know, I see these people developing software products as their only product. And I think it's just really tough for them. And yeah, to have, like you said, the ability to start it up, deliver something, get customers quickly, even if it's not the most profitable in terms of margin, I do think it's a good way to get started, because it allows you the platform to grow from there if you want to. And if not, you just scale it up and just know that you are operating on a 20% margin instead of 80. And so you just have to make a bigger business, which is not all bad. You know, one of the things that I'm just starting to really appreciate is, and this is on like a nano scale, but we have 8 people on our team. We are really providing a fair amount of sort of economic value for those people. You know, the business that we've started is providing for one person to quit her day job and do this pretty much full time and be home with, you know, her child, which is just so cool. I mean, I look at this as, you know, this is my business and we want to grow it and do all these great things. But then you step back a little bit and say, holy shit, like, we're giving someone the opportunity to do what they've always wanted through our little business that is so microscopic on the grand scheme of things, but it really is affecting someone's life kind of substantially. So
yeah,
it's really cool.
It is. I mean, it's kind of scary with that kind of responsibility, but it's also very exciting and very thrilling to work with a great team and to see them thriving as a result of working in your business. I mean, it's totally awesome.
Yeah.
And I mean, what I've found with our team is, you know, right now they're basically all freelancers. I hired them as freelancers. They came in as freelancers, and slowly they've been ramping up their hours to the point where they're like part-time, almost working half of like a full-time person and even a little bit beyond. And you know, like the feedback that I get from them is, you know, they want to transition more of their time into audience ops and away from their other clients, which I love to hear, you know. And we're a fully remote team. So, I think they all appreciate that as well. And a lot of us like to travel. I mean, I'm traveling right now long-term, and, one of our other teammates, he's not necessarily doing long-term travel, but he travels a lot. Like he's constantly on the road, and every week he seems like he's somewhere else. Which is cool, you know, cause we all kind of like work from anywhere. We use Slack and Trello and get it all done.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been really cool to kind of, you know, build up this team and also this camaraderie. That's another thing that I'm trying to learn and figure out as I go along here, is to really build some sort of team culture, beyond just Slack, you know? And that's definitely a challenge, but it's, I'd like to get to a point where we're taking team retreats or something, like where we all get to meet up or something like that. But, you know, again, taking it one step at a time.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, we have, you know, I don't know if we're a step behind or not. I talk to our team individually a lot. We're having our first call with all of us on the phone together tomorrow, actually. So that'll be really neat for people to get to chat with each other. And I think hopefully level up a few things, you know, share some the ideas, to share some best practices and things that they're concerned about with me so that I can address it sort of with our process or our people or our customers. And then, you know, let them be more comfortable in their job. So yeah, I think that culture in a distributed team is a tough thing to get real tangible, but, if you can do it, it really is optimal all around.
Yeah. The meetings thing has been something that I've tried different variations of this, and I still haven't totally figured it out. We've had a couple of full team meetings on Google Hangouts, and the couple of times that we've done it, I just found that they weren't very productive. It was a lot of, I would just say something and try to get everybody's feedback. And I think just having like the group setting and then some connection issues, it just didn't really work very well for that. Mm-hmm. Like we have great team collaboration over text within Slack. But having everybody on one group call has never been totally effective for us. The other thing that I do every month to 2 months is I schedule one-on-one calls with everyone to kind of review, you know, how your personal performance over the last month, things you're doing great, things you can do better, things that are going on in audience ops and how your role is impacting that and what's coming up so that you're aware of it. So I try to have these like catch-up calls, which have been very good. I think that's good for me to get to know each person individually. A couple of times, like when I need to roll out a new feature, like a new process or something, like I'll just record one video message and just share that recording with the team, which isn't ideal. I mean, I don't like just me speaking and not getting any feedback. But sometimes I just need to like tell everyone this is like some new thing that you need to be aware of. Mm-hmm. But I think like next week we're going to have another group call just to kind of catch up and have, you know, some group updates. So it's just something that we're figuring out as we go along.
Yeah.
Good episode. It was good. I always like, you know, comparing notes on this kind of nitty gritty behind the scenes stuff. Hopefully it's helpful. I'm sure a lot of it was kind of boring to our audience here, but, if you're in it or if you're working on things in your company or you're thinking about launching something, you know, this is a look of like what it looks like from day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, we, I think we both paint it, in very rosy but real terms, and a lot of it is very straightforward. I think if you hire the right people, it gets to be very easy to do the work, and the tough part is managing the team and the growth and the process, because that is your business. And your business is not a thing, it's a process that involves people, and that's your job as a founder, is to establish it and grow it and refine it and optimize it. That's your product. So that's what I've come to realize, is it's not the thing we're delivering. It's the organization that we're building.
Totally.
Yep. Cool. Awesome, Brian. Thanks, man.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.